Glenn Coble here on the air, and I think we have Fred Malone on the other line. Fred, are you there?
I'm with you.
Okay, I gotta shut down my music here. Hang on. All right. How you doing?
Good. I was getting a little nervous. I tried a couple of times earlier, and it kept ringing busy. So I thought, uh-oh, we got a problem.
Yeah, we're working on getting our transmitter back working. So.
Oh, okay. So yeah. That probably has a little something to do with the phone lines as well.
I'll tell you sometime later.
Okay. No problem.
But we're hoping that it'll be up and going this morning. So we may
great.
Be back on the air anytime. So
we
have Sean working on it, and that's what we're working on ourselves. And we are on the air. We have a lot of listeners that have called in that they have, what is that type of device where you say, Alexa.
Really? Oh, yeah.
We have a lot of Alexa listeners, so if you're out there listening on Alexa, thank you.
I know there are people that listen via the internet. My son lives in Florida, and he listens when he can through the internet. So, we have quite a few people that are regular listeners that way, too,
especially
across the United States, you know.
I don't know if you saw my Facebook message, but it said how to do that. But all you do is go to our website and go down, scroll down toward the bottom, and there's a thing that says "Listen Live." You click on that, and you're on.
Yeah, I think in fact, years ago, when Scott just had the station first started, my wife and I were on a little overnight trip down in Waynesville, down near Cincinnati, the antique capital of Ohio, supposedly. And we listened to Charlie.
What direction out of Cincinnati is Waynesville?
Well, it would be to the east of Cincinnati.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, not too awfully far from closer probably to Xenia than it would be to Cincinnati.
Okay.
You know where Fairborn is?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very near Fairborn.
Okay, sort of northeast.
Very near Fairborn,
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so anyway, I think we left off when last we spoke with our dear friend, Rutherford B. Hayes, an Ohio boy.
Yeah.
I think that was the last one. And we're going to start off today with James Garfield and see how far we can get.
Give our listeners a hint of what we're doing with these presidents.
Well, what we're doing with the presidents last month and again this month is we're talking about inaugurations,
right?
Presidential inaugurations, some interesting facts that occurred during their inauguration, if we have anything. Sometimes we don't. I have a number of accesses to several books and information about presidents that I use to compile this information, and sometimes I get some interesting facts on inaugurations, and other times there's hardly anything there at all other than the date and it took place, you know.
I imagine early on it wasn't covered a lot as much as it is now.
No, absolutely not. As we found out in our last segment, there wasn't a whole lot on some of those things, although I was just talking to a friend of mine this morning, and John Quincy Adams comes to mind. If you recall, last month when we talked about him, on the morning of his inauguration, he got up, ate a hearty breakfast, and took a swim in the Potomac River to start the day. So,
brains haven't always been at the forefront.
Well, you never know what you're gonna find, and so in this segment, I've included some other interesting facts with some of the presidents when I couldn't find much on the inauguration. But again, you know, history is so much fun. It tells us where we've been, and maybe sometimes gives us a hint of where we're going.
Yeah.
And it often is the case. History does repeat itself, which we've seen in some instances.
Yeah.
And of course, we just went through that insurrection at the Capitol building January the 6th, and we're going to talk about another insurrection that occurred a number of years ago this morning.
Fantastic. So, let's get to it.
Well, let's start with James Garfield. James Garfield was another Ohio boy.
Yeah, we've had a lot.
Another Civil War veteran, he was elected president and took office in 1881. He was actually nominated on the 36th ballot.
Holy cow.
And so he wasn't anybody's first choice, kind of a dark horse that came along, much like a couple of other presidents as we go forward.
Sure.
But at his inauguration, which took place on March the 4th of 1881, a number of visitors had climbed up on top of the Capitol dome.
Oh, my.
where they had a full view of Pennsylvania Avenue and could watch the inauguration from there. And, you know, obviously they weren't stopping people from doing that in those days. So, I'm not quite sure there was how they got up there, but apparently from what I'm able to find out, there were quite a few people that did that. Oh. The interesting thing about with Garfield coming into office, there was still a bitterness between the North and the South, which was kind of becoming a thing of the past when he took office. Rutherford B. Hayes, his predecessor, had actually withdrawn the last of the federal troops. Now, carpetbaggery had ended after 10 weary years, and while home rule had returned to the southern states, things weren't quite calmed down yet. Mm-hmm. An interesting event occurred during the inauguration procession, which kind of symbolized this growing harmony, when a group of ex-Confederate soldiers broke through the crowd on Pennsylvania Avenue, waving the Union flag, and cheered Garfield and the retiring President Hayes from above. So, you know, things were starting to get a little bit better by that time. Now, also, I found another interesting thing that took place during the inauguration inside the Capitol Rotunda. And apparently for some time before that, in the Great Circular Hall, there was actually a bazaar going on where, now I mean a bazaar, not in something bizarre, but what you would call a bazaar, like a flea market.
Yeah, they could have called into a swap shop, yeah.
Right, exactly, where a number of peddlers were selling a variety of their wares, including stoves, a buggy whip, snake oil, mousetraps, kitchen utensils, and even pianos. So can you imagine the rotunda of the Capitol building full of all these people hawking their different things?
Can you imagine taking the piano down all those stairs?
Oh, my word. Yeah. You know, that took, you know, was that the old saying is 6 men and a boy, probably.
Yeah.
Up in there. Well, unfortunately, of course, as we all know, on July the 2nd of 1881, less than 4 months after Garfield's inauguration, a demented office seeker by the name of Charles Guiteau fired 2 shots at the president as he stood with the Secretary of State, James Blaine, in the Baltimore Potomac Depot in Washington, D.C. So he lingered throughout the summer, dying then on September the 19th, thus ending his presidency and starting the presidency of Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah.
Now, not a lot is known about Chester Arthur. He was kind of a quiet individual. And I think when we were talking about elections a couple of months ago, we mentioned that Chester Arthur had really never held any political office until he was selected as vice president for James Garfield. He had been a commissioner of the harbor in New York City or New York State, which was actually an appointed political job, but he never was elected to any job.
He was the chair of the New York Republican Party, so he had a lot of political power.
He did have a lot of political power, but never elected to any office until that time.
Interesting.
So, being the fact that he took over in September when Garfield died, he was actually sworn in at his Lexington Avenue home in New York at 1:30 in the afternoon on September the 20th. And this was actually 2 days later. They did do a formal inauguration ceremony in Washington, but nothing like we would have seen had it been a normal inauguration in March, right, like it was for Garfield.
Did he make a speech?
Well, there isn't any information available. I've tried to find, I'm trying to find several speeches where I could pull excerpts from them, but I couldn't find anything on Chester Arthur. And I think, of course, that's probably in the same situation that Gerry Ford found himself in when he took over for Richard Nixon. You know, you're just in front of a few people in the green room of the White House or whatever room you're in, taking your oath of office. So that's about all I could find on Chester Arthur.
Okay.
Next up, we have Grover Cleveland.
Yeah.
Now, of course, interestingly enough, he was the only president to serve 2 terms with another president in between, and we'll talk more about that as we move on.
All right.
During his first term, of course, he was from New York State. He was called Grover the Good by the Democratic Party. He held many offices while he was in New York. He was an attorney by trade. He had little formal education to begin with. There was no wealth, no family prestige. He wasn't particularly attractive physically. He weighed 260 pounds, so he wasn't quite as big as William Howard Taft, but he was a pretty good-sized man. Mm-hmm. Had a big bull neck, and he really didn't have much of a gift of the oratory. He wasn't much of a public speaker. However, he was had great independence and courage. He was very honest. He was successfully elected sheriff of Erie County in New York. He was mayor of Buffalo and also was governor of the state. And I thought this was kind of interesting. He, as sheriff, he personally hanged two murderers rather than give the unpleasant task to any of his deputies.
Oh, my.
He actually did the hanging.
Jeez.
Pulled the lever.
Oh, God.
And let him swing, which I thought was kind of interesting for, you know, for a president.
Obviously, he wasn't. He was in favor of the death penalty.
Yeah, quite obviously. Well, he performed his duties as sheriff without passing it on to anybody else.
Yeah, I noticed he had his first term. He had his vice president was Adlai Stevenson the first. Is that related, obviously, to Adlai Stevenson? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. There's a family line there, right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Sorry.
during the inaugural ceremonies, he and Chester Arthur reviewed the parade from a stand in front of the White House. That's really about all I could find with regard to his inauguration. So very little known on that inauguration ceremony.
They had a parade for him.
That's true. That's true. I'm sure they did down Pennsylvania Avenue.
There you go.
But, of course, when he ran for re-election, he was defeated by another Ohioan, Benjamin Harrison.
Yeah.
Benjamin Harrison, grandson of our ninth president, William Henry Harrison.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
I didn't realize he was a grandson of
Harrison. Yes, he was a grandson of William Henry, who only survived 30 days in office because he caught a cold or pneumonia during his 2.5-hour speech
outside.
At the inauguration outside in inclement weather and died 30 days later. But, he was the grandson of our ninth president. Hmm. He was, of course, as we're going to talk about, sandwiched between those two Cleveland administrations. Mm-hmm. And I might want to mention that the gentleman that portrays Benjamin Harrison for us at the Marion County Historical Society is listening this morning.
Very good.
Yeah, he's from Shelby. Tom Batchelder is his name, and his wife Caroline. Carolyn portrays Harrison's wife, Caroline.
That's kind of interesting.
They both have the same name.
Yeah.
The men who put Harrison in office, the rich manufacturers seeking high tariff benefits.
From NBC News,
we got take
this
break.
Is Today with Matt Lauer and Meredith Vieira.
Wow, that was a special morning doing the opening for the Today Show in 2011.
Yes, but you know what? There was a downside.
What was that?
Having to share a dressing room with Willard Scott. Smucker jars everywhere.
WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM, The Talking Place.
Three, two, one. Oh, no. Which button am I...
When every second counts, you can't wing it.
Guys, a little help up here?
In a home fire, you may have less than 2 minutes to get out. So make a family home fire escape plan. Then practice home fire drills at least twice a year so everyone knows what to do when they hear... Prepare your family at ready.gov/firedrill. Brought to you by FEMA, the Ad Council, and Make Safe Happen.
I'm sorry about that, Fred.
Oh, no problem.
I've got to keep my eye on the clock.
Well, I was trying to watch it, too, and I kind of got distracted and... Yep. It snuck up on me, so to speak.
All right, let's
anyway,
come back.
His campaign was funded basically by a lot of rich manufacturers. They were seeking high tariff benefits.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really kind of does.
A lot of those guys have done that.
Well, they actually did not expect their man to shape the policies of the government as Cleveland had done, and he didn't really disappoint them. His administration was more responsive to the special interests than any since Grant. Now, unlike Grant, however, he was free from scandal, and his regime was really an honest one. He was an honest man. He had served in the Indiana legislature before being elected to the United States Senate, where he did serve one term without much distinction, but again, he was honest and did his job. He was defeated for re-election, for that Senate seat and left Washington in 1887, convinced that his political career was really behind him. And here, 2 years later, he finds himself being elected as President of the United States.
Pretty amazing.
Now, life in the White House with the Harrisons was kind of like his administration. It was plain and really uneventful. There was very little entertaining, no real glamorous dinners like some of his predecessors had held. The systematic president never really varied his daily habits. He had breakfast at 8, followed by a half hour of prayer by the entire family.
A half
closeted
hour?
Together in one room. What's that?
A half hour
a
of
half
prayer?
An hour of prayer.
Holy
yep.
cow.
Together in the same room. He ate lunch at 1 o'clock. He ate an early dinner and went to bed early. Now, interestingly enough, they had just installed new electric lights in the White House in 1891.
Cool.
And these really kind of baffled the Harrisons. And as Tom will tell you when he talks about Harrison, they were kind of mesmerized by them. They let the lights burn all night in the halls and the parlors, fearing that if they turned them off, they would get a shock from the electricity. They were actually shut off by the White House electrician when he came on duty the next morning. That's how afraid they were to even come close to it. For a long time, the Harrisons did not use the lights in their bedrooms and were even fearful of pushing those electric bell buttons. Remember how the I don't know, when you were a kid, I know when I was, we had the exposed cords on the walls in the house that we lived on at the farm, and
yes.
there was a button that turned the lights on and
yeah.
off, and of course the cords
And those cords looked like you could get a shock just off the cords.
They did. They yeah. really did. But that was, you know, the initial, the way that they wired homes back in those days.
They were covered with cotton, I believe.
I'm sorry?
They were covered with cotton fabric or something like that.
Yeah, they were an insulated type wire.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can imagine how they would have been fearful of something like
yeah.
that, having never experienced that before, and having lived in homes that didn't have electric or anything like that. So,
yeah.
And interestingly enough, I have a friend that has a vintage home in Delaware that was built in the 1880s that he's been remodeling, but taking back to its original aura,
mm-hmm.
and in his kitchen, which he totally tore out and redid here over the past year, he put that same kind of wiring in his kitchen.
Oh, my.
And he was actually able to find some new old stock of that wiring on the Internet. And what he couldn't find enough of, he found, had been remanufactured by a company that still makes that wire.
I'm surprised that the codes allowed him to do it.
Yeah, well,
he must have gotten an exception for his...
It was new old stock, yeah. And then, like I said, what he couldn't find that was new old stock, he was able to buy brand new that has been manufactured to look like the old. So,
very interesting
project.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know. So that's kind of what I have about the Harrisons.
Okay.
And I'm sure if I miss anything, any really good tidbits, Tom will let me know.
Okay, but he will. He can't call in today because you're on the phone.
No, he can't call in today because we're on the phone. Yeah, we're on the phone. Well, come election time, Harrison was sent home,
mm-hmm.
and Grover Cleveland won his unprecedented second term in office. The only president, as they said, before or since, to serve another term after being sent home after his first term. Now, will we see that happen again with Donald J.
Well, he's
in 2024?
Might be thinking about it.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who absolutely knows?
Yeah.
When Mrs. This is an interesting tidbit. I don't want to throw this out before we talk a little bit more about it. But when Mrs. Cleveland departed from the White House after their first term, an hour or so before the Harrisons moved in, she said to the staff, and I quote, "Take good care of all the furniture and ornaments in the house, for I want to find everything just as it is now when we come back again."
Oh, my.
We are coming back just 4 years from today.
She was sure.
4 years to the day on March the 4th of 1893, and this was March the 4th of 1889, she said this, "In a sleet storm, Cleveland drove up Pennsylvania Avenue, but the sight of the man who had taken the presidency from him before and was now returning it to him."
Oh my. I wonder if they took care of everything for her.
Well, I don't know. Couldn't find any information like that, but I thought that was pretty pretentious of her to make that statement.
I guess.
but hey, you know, strange things happen, don't you know?
Yeah.
Well, after Mr. Cleveland left office, he only served one term. And I oftentimes wonder, you know, there wasn't any reason why he couldn't have served another term, because there was no restriction in the Constitution.
Of course, he could have gone on forever. Yeah.
Yeah. But the next election found William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan in the fight. Mm-hmm. And of course, William McKinley was the winner of that election in 1901. William McKinley, another Ohio man, another Civil War veteran, a major in the Civil War from Niles and Canton, Ohio.
He's certainly an austere-looking gentleman.
Well,
in this picture that I
yes, and he is an ancestor of mine. I don't look a lot like him, with the exception of the bags under the eyes, and that's a McKinley trait.
Okay.
My mother was a McKinley, and all the McKinleys carry those bags under their eyes.
Okay.
Beyond that, most of my looks, I think, came from my father's side of the family, the Malone side, but
okay.
I do have the McKinley eyes.
Well, this picture of him, his eyes are a little scary.
yeah, they were kind of scary looking.
Yeah.
And, you know, rarely did you see him smile. He was a very stone-faced individual, and when you find out a little bit of the history of his life with his wife, you kind of understand that.
Couldn't have been as bad as Lincoln's life with his wife.
No, Ida wasn't that type of individual. She was a very quiet individual, but she was very sickly. No more devoted or more pathetic couple ever dwelt in the White House. Other than the McKinleys, truly. When Ida Saxon, she was a Saxon from Canton. Her father was a banker in Canton. She was very well educated. She was very pretty when she was younger, actually. I've got some pictures of her when she was young, and she was a very pretty girl.
Oh, we're all good looking when we're young.
Well, some of us. but when she married McKinley in 1871, she had every reason to look forward to a life of normal happiness. They had actually been walking to church together for about a year and a half before he ever popped the question. But they really, you know, expected happiness, as most married couples do when they first start life together. But within three years, she lost her mother and two daughters.
Oh, my.
Two baby daughters. And these losses so shattered her nervous system that she actually developed epilepsy from
geez. It. It's amazing how many children of presidents died back in the early days. But I guess a lot of children died in the early days.
Yeah, it was just clearly a sign of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you walk through older cemeteries, it's not surprising to see how many tombstones are there with young children under the age of, well, a lot of them under the age of 2 years old.
Yeah.
But especially, and that's the way with McKinley's. His oldest daughter was four when she died, and the other one was less than a year old. So, you know, it wasn't unusual. So many different things fell to the children, you know.
Yeah.
But this issue really caused the epilepsy that she carried for the rest of her life. And she couldn't tell from one minute to the next when she would have an epileptic spell and basically fall, into an unconscious state or some sort of almost like someone that had narcolepsy or something like that.
A grand mal seizure of sorts.
Yeah. Now, and he was so patient and kind with her. I portrayed McKinley before at presidential dinners, and my wife has portrayed Ida. And one of the things that he was known for doing, if she felt one of these epileptic seizures coming on, and they were together, she would grasp his hand and squeeze, and that was her sign to him that he needed to take the handkerchief from his pocket and just place it over her face, because she would sometimes contort her face, obviously, with these epileptic seizures, and being in public, they did not want these seizures to be seen by the public.
And scare people.
And when the seizure was over, would pass, she would remove the handkerchief.
Huh.
So they tried to play it down as much as they possibly could, but he responded to her every whim. He shielded her, you know, insisting that she go everywhere with him, but also always aware that he would respond to her summons when she was, you know, felt one of these coming on.
Wow.
When he was not working, he didn't take any recreation. He didn't golf or play poker or any of the things that some of the other presidents did. He remained at her side, you know, basically trying to make her existence more livable. The first inauguration, really nothing spectacular about that. The second inauguration, when he was reelected, took place on March the 4th of 1901. Now, of course, we know that 1901 for President McKinley didn't turn out to be such a great term of office. He was, about 6 months after the inauguration in September. He was in Buffalo, New York, attending the Pan American Exposition. And he was visiting, or I guess standing in a receiving line to visit constituents as they walked up to shake his hand.
Sure.
Unlike, you would not see that taking place today.
No.
And when McKinley was president, there really wasn't a Secret Service at that point in time. Grant had basically established a Secret Service when he was in office a number of years before that, but it wasn't like the Secret Service of today when there are numerous officers everywhere.
Yeah.
He had one gentleman that was assigned to him from the Washington Police Department, and one other gentleman that traveled with him that was, I guess you could call him a special assistant or a special officer of the quote-unquote Secret Service. And those were the only two people that was with him in the receiving line. And when the assassin approached him, he had his hand wrapped up like it was in a bandage, and within that bandage he had a .32 caliber revolver. When he approached McKinley, he reached out with his left hand to shake hands with the president, and with his right hand finger on the revolver, he fired two shots into the president, both entering the abdomen area, one a little lower than the other, and unfortunately, McKinley did not survive. Yeah. It looked for a while like he may, but in late September, and I believe it was the 21st, he passed away while still in Buffalo, New York.
Boy, we've had, how many presidents have we had assassinated? Do you know?
Well, Garfield was the first, then McKinley, or Lincoln, then Garfield, then McKinley, and then Kennedy.
Yeah.
So we've had four.
Wow.
Yeah, we've had four.
Well, we're just about at our next break, so.
Okay, so we'll just kind of hold up before we jump
into. Yeah, we've only got about 20 seconds, so. Yeah, let's hold up.
Before we jump into Roosevelt.
I was going to say Roosevelt's probably a pretty big inauguration, I would guess. But we'll hear about that in about 2 minutes and 8 seconds. What do you say?
All right.
Hang on.
Charlie, do you remember when Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood came to visit us?
Yes, I do. All three times. What a great time we had.
Yes, riding in the popcorn parade twice with him was great.
He made more speedy deliveries that day than the post office does all year.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Don't miss it.
Has taken everything and everyone I've ever loved away from me. Everything.
I blew my ankle out and I got prescribed pain pills by my doctor.
If making my detox public is going to help somebody, I'm all for it. I just wish I would have had a warning.
Opioid dependence can happen after just 5 days. Know the truth, spread the truth. A message from Truth, the Ad Council, and ONDCP.
Well, we're back here with Fred Malone from the Marion Historical Society talking about inaugurations of presidents. Hey, Fred, I noticed that McKinley's vice president was Garrett Hobart.
First vice president.
And I lived in Valparaiso, Indiana for several years, which is right next to Hobart, Indiana. I'm guessing that's named after him.
Could very well have been. I'm not exactly sure of that connection, but it's a great possibility. He actually died in office, so McKinley didn't have a vice president for about the last year and a half.
Oh, yeah, it says none in the last year.
Yeah, about the last year and a half of the first term. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear about Mr. Roosevelt.
Well, on September the 13th of 1901, Roosevelt was in the heart of the Adirondacks. which is no surprise.
No surprise at all, yeah.
With a guide, or when a guide brought him a telegram to the effect that McKinley was dying. Roosevelt didn't even know he'd been shot, obviously, because he was camping. He quickly made way to Buffalo. Didn't get there right away. It took about 13 hours after the president had died before he actually took the oath of office. He actually took the oath of office right in Buffalo in the home of Dr. Milford, poor President Kennedy, I almost said President Kennedy, where President McKinley passed away. So it wasn't nothing spectacular there, obviously, like any other president that would have died in office. Normally, those swearing-in ceremonies were only, you know, witnessed by a very few people.
Right.
On the McKinley funeral train leaving Buffalo, Mark Hanna, who had who was a lifelong friend of McKinley and really was he was an attorney from Canton and really was the one that talked McKinley into running for president. And Mark Hanna was the one that suggested that Theodore Roosevelt be McKinley's running mate in the election, the second term election. On this funeral train, Mark Hanna said, "Now look, that damned cowboy is president of the United States." And here's the issue. Back in those days, the vice president of the United States was basically a no one. They were just basically a president in waiting in case something happened. They had no say in anything other than they did preside over the Senate as the president of the Senate if there was an issue where there was a tie like we have today.
Right.
But basically, they had no function, and most presidents did not include them in the daily operation of the country.
Huh.
So Mark Hanna, in suggesting that Theodore Roosevelt be McKinley's running mate, figured it was a good way to pigeonhole him and get him out of the way, because he had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy under the first administration, and basically he was the one that you might say pushed us into the Spanish-American War.
Uh-huh.
The Secretary of the Navy at the time happened to be out of town when the Maine was blown up in the harbor, in Havana Harbor, and that kind of gave Roosevelt the impetus to push that war effort. And McKinley didn't really want a war. So Hanna suggested that this would be a way to get him out of the limelight. We would never have to deal with him again. Well, you see what happened. McKinley gets assassinated, and boom, here you go. He's now president of the United States. So it was kind of appropriate that McKinley, or that Hanna would say on the funeral train of McKinley, is that here that cowboy is now president of the United States, and he had nobody to blame but himself.
Absolutely. There's a lot of that goes on in politics.
Oh, my word. Perhaps the most important battle that he ever fought was one with himself, though, which he lost, but which turned out to be a turning point in his career, and we're talking about the vice presidency.
Mm-hmm.
When it was first offered to him in 1900 by Tom Platt, who was a Republican boss of New York, Roosevelt said this, and I quote, "I would a great deal rather be anything than vice president." 9 days before the convention, he wrote this, and quote, "I will not accept under any circumstances, that is all there is about it." So he wasn't going to do it. But when Roosevelt was convinced that his refusal might mean the election of William Jennings Bryan, who was really a kind of a radical in his day,
mm-hmm.
he reluctantly accepted the nomination. Having lost the battle with himself, he said this, and I quote, "I do not expect to go any further in politics."
Oh, my.
Because he pretty much knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, he knew that he was going to be pigeonholed, and that was pretty much going to be the end of his career.
And fate took over.
I'm sorry?
And then fate took over.
And fate took over. And then, of course, when McKinley's term was finished or would have run out at the end of 1904, he ran for re-election, or ran for election, I should say, on his own, even though he was being re-elected as president, and of course was elected president,
mm-hmm.
and served another term on his own. And of course, the thing about Roosevelt, he was larger than life. There have been so many books written about him, you can't even count them all. And he toyed with the idea of running for another term, which, again, he could have. There would have been no reason why he shouldn't. But I think he felt that there's a number of schools of thought. I think he felt that he'd done what he could do at this particular point in time, and he had a lot of things that he wanted to do in his post-presidency. He wanted to travel, which he did tremendously. But we owe a lot, a debt of gratitude to Roosevelt for his work with establishing all of the national parks
and the
areas in this country that are protected. Even though there were some national parks before he came along, he was really the one that promoted and got us more.
I'm trying to remember the name of the gentleman who established Yellowstone Park.
Well, there was Gilbert Pinchot, was one.
It started with an M.
John Muir.
Yes, they were John good Muir. Friends, I believe, weren't they?
Yes, in fact, Roosevelt spent a number of camping trips with John Muir in Yellowstone. In fact, there was one time that Roosevelt was visiting Yellowstone when he and Muir actually snuck off, and the Secret Service didn't know where he was, and they were gone for a couple of days with no communication whatsoever, no idea where they were in the park, and of course, you know how large Yellowstone
is. Huge,
No way to find them, but they were out camping and doing their thing, and so, you know, obviously that was what he loved to do. He was an outdoorsman, and just a minute.
That's all right. I hear a phone call ringing.
Well, I'm on my cell phone. It was one of those crazy robocalls. So he was out camping and doing his thing, and he didn't want anybody around other than him and Muir.
Yeah.
So, you know, that happened quite frequently with
Can
him.
You imagine if that would happen now?
Oh, my word. The Secret Service would be absolutely out of their mind. Out of their mind.
Okay.
So we owe a lot to Roosevelt from that standpoint. And, you know, again, with his escapade with the Rough Riders before he was vice president, when he was still assistant secretary of the Navy, he had to resign that position to get an appointment as a colonel. So he could lead a regiment of a hodgepodge group of guys that come from all different parts of the country. A lot of them, when he was out west, he had a ranch out west in the early years of his life. And some of the fellows that were cowboys that came from out west, there were just a number of, rough guys, you might want to say, that he put together for this regiment. And, of course, he's famously known for the charge up San Juan Hill and what happened in Cuba during the Spanish uprising.
Was it true that he, after he decided not to run for his third term, it wouldn't have been nowadays, it would be considered his second term, but was it true that he kind of kicked himself, that he thought, I made a mistake, I should have run?
Later on, he did, and he supported William Howard Taft, another Ohioan, in Taft's bid to become president, to be his successor. He was really, you might say, he was really Roosevelt's handpicked successor.
Yeah.
And things went along pretty well for about the first year or so of Taft's presidency. He was pretty much following the guide of what Roosevelt had laid out, what Roosevelt thought that he would do, and then all of a sudden, he kind of became a rogue, and it made Roosevelt extremely unhappy. Which we find, in 1912, Roosevelt decides to run again. So, and we can talk a little bit more about that when we get to the end of that. So, Roosevelt decides not to run and handpicks Big Bill Taft, our largest president. He stood 6 feet 2 inches tall.
Oh.
He weighed over 300 pounds and was the only man in American history to hold the two offices, the two highest offices in the land, the presidency and, do you know the other?
Supreme Court Justice, right?
He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, right. And he was actually appointed by Warren Harding.
I didn't know that.
Chief Justice, another Ohio president.
Sure.
Yeah, so the good-natured, jovial Taft had no taste for politics. He enjoyed being a judge. He was a judge in the Cincinnati Circuit Court for a number of years and really enjoyed that position. But again, Roosevelt talked him into running, and he was successful. He was really lacking in kind of an executive force and probably would have been better off if he had never been lured into taking the presidency. He was a very brilliant man. He was second in his class of 121 people at Yale when he graduated college. And he spent the first 20 years of his career as a law officer and a judge in the court. But he always wanted to be on the Supreme Court. Now, he did turn down a couple of earlier offers to be a justice on the Supreme Court from, one was from McKinley. But he had his eye on the prize, so to speak. He wanted to be Chief Justice, and he held out. And as we find later on, he makes that. When Warren Harding becomes president, he did elect him. And, of course, everyone, or did appoint him. Of course, everyone knows the story about the bathtub.
Yeah.
About being stuck in the bathtub, which there is some controversy over whether that actually occurred or not. It makes great folklore.
Though. Yeah,
one
absolutely.
Of those, what do they call one of those urban legends?
Yeah, urban legends,
like
Political legend.
Political legends. So anyway, it comes time to run for re-election, and he did decide to run for re-election, and he was going to be running against a guy by the name of Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
And Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, William Howard Taft, a Republican. Teddy is not happy. Teddy could not get the Republican nomination. He tried in the beginning, but when he saw the handwriting on the wall that the party was not going to give him the nomination, they were going to give the nomination to the sitting president, he formed his own party called the Progressive Party, or as affectionately known as the Bull Moose Party.
I love that name.
Oh, I do too. And when you look at Roosevelt and you look at his history and you look at his career and you look at who he was kind of a bull moose charging through everything he did in life.
Sure.
So because of that, that was a three-way race that year for president. And unfortunately, Taft finished dead last in the three-way race. Wilson, the Democrat, won. Roosevelt came in second. Poor old Taft was sucking the hind one, as they used to say years ago. But he left the White House in 1913 with no regrets. As he departed, he said this to the President Wilson incoming, "I'm glad to be going. This is the lonesomest place in the world."
Oh, my. Yeah, I bet it is.
But he did find contentment. He was a law professor at Yale for 9 years. And then in 1921, he was appointed to our friend Warren G. Harding from Marion, Ohio, to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he served in that capacity until his death in 1930. I think we'll start there.
We're going to have to pick up Woodrow Wilson here after the break.
And we'll be back in, 15 minutes?
About 15 minutes, yeah.
All right.
Well, we're talking to Fred Malone of the Marion Historical
You're
Society.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, LP, Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place to Legendary.